I think Barclays were known at the time to have the largest lunch bill in London, with something like 42,000 and 10,000 euro bottles of Château Petrus wine that came from our trading floor. So wasn't at the epicenter, but I was around it. But I got away from London with my senses, which is something that some people didn't.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Niall White, fellow Irishman from Capstack, and we're going to dive. I had a recent guest who told me something very interesting, which was that 80% of businesses that go to market do not sell. But more interesting for me is, of those 20% that do sell, 18 months later, 75% of the owners or sellers are dissatisfied with their decision. So Niall has a storied history in corporate finance, private equity, managing takeovers of businesses. In fact, he's completed been involved in more than $10 billion worth of deals over his career since 2007. And we're going to get into some of that today. And we're also going to talk about his unique insight into how to make a deal work post-sale. So everyone's very interested in the transaction itself, with all the juicy fees and the excitement and the big day out. But actually, where the rubber hits the road, both for the seller and the buyer, is post-acquisition. And Niall has unique experience in this area. So Niall, thank you very much for being on the show. And maybe you could kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Well, it's a pleasure. You're very welcome, James. Good to be on the show. What do people hope to people may or may not know about me? I suppose it always comes back to people. And I've met some very interesting people over the years. But one of the most interesting people that I've met is a former boss. I'm sorry, met or worked with him for a number of years, a former boss in my London days. And I was very interested at the time reading a book called Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis. Very interested in reading it. And I asked him, had he read it? Because I knew he'd worked in Wall Street in the 1980s. He said, I didn't need to read it because I was actually in there. I worked in Salomon Brothers. I worked in Louis Ranieri's team. And Michael Lewis was a colleague of mine. So I found that very interesting at the time. Henry's a really interesting guy and is in around the time that The Big Short was happening live. And Michael Lewis was the author of that book, who subsequently came out a couple of years after GFC in 2008, was subsequently made into a movie. So Michael Lewis is, I suppose, the thread between the interesting piece of information that I have in relation to people I worked closely with from that time in selling mortgage bonds in the 1980s, right the way through to GFC and The Big Short, which came out, I don't know, film probably came out about 10, 12 years ago.
Very good. So I have to ask you about London in the 80s. It's the loads of money era. If you're brought up in the UK and Ireland, you'll remember Harry Enfield's skit on, you know, almost the ostentatious lifestyle. I was probably 10 years after that in the 90s. I also went to London, like many Irish guys do. Was it as ostentatious as the movies like Wolf of Wall Street, I guess, would lead you to believe? Or had all that died down by the time you got there?
It, to a certain extent, it died down. I was there in the noughties from 2002 to 2008. And actually, the really interesting piece about that was that Henry had a really interesting backstory. As I was leaving London in 2008, he's in the process of having a Spitfire made because he was a keen pilot. And he's going to land it in his land out in the home counties just outside of London. But the relevance of that was that he was really keen. He wanted to join the RAF, but he failed the process because he had eyesight defects, which prevented him from being a fighter pilot. So with that disappointment, he packed his bags and moved to Wall Street, and I think in about 1984. Joined Salomon Brothers, which is just about to boom with trading mortgage bonds, and was right in the epicenter of that kind of loads of money type of era in Wall Street over the other side of the pond from London. And it all took off a big bang then. And obviously what happened in 1987, it happened in 87. So I have a few people who I worked closely with and, you know, had a few of the battle scars in relation to that, but also, you know, tales of how I suppose egregious some of the behavior was. But listen, I joined Barclays Capital in 2004, and we were funding buyouts by big private equity firms like, you know, CVC, Terra Firma, KKR, all of these kind of big names. And, you know, whilst we were working hard and working late hours, there was some enjoyment there. It wasn't kind of loads of money frivolity, but there was, you know, I think Barclays were known at the time to have the largest lunch bill in London, which was the story that came around at the time, something of 42,000 and 10,000 euro bottles of Chateau Petrus wine that came from our trading floor. So wasn't at the epicenter, but I was around it. But I got away from London with my senses, which is something that some people didn't.
That's the thing that struck me there. Lunches were the thing, because everyone had to get their train to go back out to the Shires after the work was over. And the trains were quite long. You know, there would be two or three hours on a train sometimes.
Yeah. And the other thing about those traders, they worked really hard, but not long hours. So they would arrive in early in the morning. They'd often be at the desk by 6:30 and ready for the markets to open. But, you know, if you wanted to catch them, you had to get them kind of mid-morning, because as things started dying down about 10:30, 11:30, they had an opportunity to talk to you about whatever you needed to talk to them about. And by lunchtime, their day was over. So those guys didn't really stick around from early afternoon onwards. But in fairness, they had been in early, and if the trade had gone well, their day was done.
Yeah. My maybe lowest experience or most memorable is that my boss, when I was there, I was just an intern, and my boss went for lunch, and for some reason, someone challenged him to down a pint at lunch, and he did it, and then he did it again, and then an hour later I was carrying him in the very fancy offices of number one London Bridge, PwC's offices there. I was literally carrying him on my shoulders, pushing him through the security turnstiles, carrying up into the, you know, putting him into a side office, waiting till 4 o'clock for his train, and then picking him up again and getting him back onto the train. And that's how I got my bonus that summer. But not for anything more auspicious than that, but it was a crazy time. Okay, let's move on. So let's just establish, we've touched on it already, but you know, you don't get to be on the Gross Profit Podcast without having the right backup in terms of your credentials. Yeah. So tell us a bit about how you got credentialed in the world of finance. And you touched briefly there on some of your experience, but tell us about some of your biggest career highlights so far.
Well, how it all started, I started out as a chartered accountant, and I was fortunate enough to be able to dropped in. I started out in BDO, my training contract. And the great thing about BDO at the time was you went through the kind of audit process for 3 years. They dropped into different departments, and I was dropped in, fortunately enough, into the corporate finance department. So I worked there actually for half of my training contract and then full time after I qualified in 2000. So I worked in BDO corporate finance in Dublin for best part of, well, from 1997 to 2002, then moved to BDO in London from 2002 to 2004, and then Barclays Capital 2004-2008. So that gave me a good mix between what we call mid-market corporate finance transaction, advising on corporate finance transactions, to the larger ticket private equity buyouts with Barclays Capital, which is an investment bank at the time. I think it's known as Barclays Investment Bank now. So that gave me a spread between what we call mid-market private equity deals and larger ticket, both from the advisory side of BDO and also from the lending kind of senior mezzanine and securitization market, which became a dirty word in right away up until we did our last deal in early 2007. Which was
maybe you could just explain that. What is that?
Well, the largest deal we did was the Alliance Boots by Stefano Pessina and KKR, which happened, I think, around Q2 2007, if memory serves me correctly. And we funded the buy for KKR, provided them significant leverage against it, and that was a 10.6 billion buy it off the stock market. So, yeah, so from point of view of why I'm here and some sort of credibility to be in the Gross Profit Podcast is to do with the fact that, you know, I have some interesting experience in terms of what we call mid-market deals, which is anything with an enterprise value between 5 and 50 million pounds, euros, dollars, and larger ticket. And we did anything from 150 million up to that 10.6 billion of deal size in Barclays. So some interesting kind of war stories along the way. But of most relevance here is the experience I've picked up, both as a chartered accountant and in the corporate finance arena. And sometimes, vast majority of the time, the corporate finance has been about, you know, the positive side of doing transactions, but there has been some experience, especially in 2009, 2010, and subsequently, when it's about, you know, applying your corporate finance skills to more kind of turnaround situations whereby companies go in a slightly different direction than people like them to go, and you need to be able to rescue them back onto track.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about a topic. Selfishly, I'm interested in this topic because there is a natural tendency towards pushing towards a sale as the sort of, or the pinnacle of a business, right? So that seems to be the general trend. And I guess I've never really come from that house, if you like. There's a, in tech world, a company called Basecamp, famous influential tech people who, but their thing has been always focus on profit, run a profitable business. Don't worry about anything else. You're not trying to find a bigger fool. You're just trying to run a business for its own purpose, you know, and to make a profit, go home, get it up and do it again the next day. And yet there's an inevitable push towards sometimes this. So obviously everyone's got to retire. Sometimes businesses get into distress and the existing executives don't prove competent to fix that issue. And there's all these reasons why you might actually be forced out. And I referenced at the top of the show that frequently, you know, even though we laud exit events in the press, the people behind it are often not very satisfied with the outcome, you know. And what's interesting about, you've told me about your expertise, is really you've developed this experience coming in and dealing with that sort of post-acquisition setup. I think the first one was with it for an Irish PLC where you were doing some of that. So tell us a bit about maybe a sample deal there of a typical acquisition that you would be involved in and your role in, you know, having the acquisition being decided upon and the bankers having taken their fat fees home and everything, and, you know, and you were left there with a business you had to try and make a return on, right? So that's the trick.
Yeah, and as I said at the top, and you referred to it there as well, you know, businesses for me are all about people. You can be in a particular market segment, you can be have a particular product, a particular USP, and that can all be very attractive. But if you don't have the right people on board, it's very difficult to make the business work, certainly in the medium to longer term. So you're right. One of the things that I learned quite acutely when I went in-house to an Irish PLC in the mergers and acquisitions team was what it's like to buy a business and to then have to integrate it, because, you know, it's all well and good advising on it. And as you say, you know, all the advisors, bankers get their fees when the deal is done and there's a big after party, and that's great and glamorous. But, you know, what happens on day one when you're actually left with this new business that you have to plug into your infrastructure? And that's, I suppose, one of the most interesting parts of it for me, and especially if they're not businesses of similar structure. So if you're a PLC which has a professional management team, has public shareholders, that has all types of reporting obligations, and you operate in a certain way, and you like a business that is entrepreneur, owner-led, and, you know, maybe doesn't have the systems in place that is required, you know, integrating that kind of business can often be problematic. And, you know, you have certain types of businesses out there that go and acquire to acquire profit and grow their profit line. But for me, the interesting thing, or the most important thing in acquisition, is that it's value accretive. In other words, if you buy the business, you've got to be able to take that business and make it even more profitable, valuable than it is in its current format, its current structure as a buyer. So you're looking at a situation whereby, as a buyer, big PLC, you want to be able to bolt it on, you want to get the synergies, you want to be able to get more value back from your rate of return than you would if you didn't make the acquisition and outlay that cost and that cost of capital. But the most interesting side for me, I suppose, is having been on that side, is what it's like to be a seller. There's one business in particular where it was quite entrepreneurial-led business. There was, you know, it was quite autocratic, and they had an entrepreneur at the top, hadn't got a fully professionalized management team, you know, looked at the business as a cash flow for him in essence, which is fine if that's what you want from a business and you just want to keep on running it like that for 20 years. You're perfectly entitled to, as a shareholder, director of that business, to do that. But if you're then coming to a situation where you want to realize the value in that business and you want to separate it from the business owner, the business has got to be what I would call autonomous, and the value and control has to be in the entity that is being bought and not the owner. In one situation is we bought a business for $7 million up front and $3 million in a two-year earnout. And the business owner was quite entrepreneurial, quite flash, had the $7 million in his back pocket after tax, whatever it was, and went out and bought the 911 Porsche and did all the rest of that. And as he's enjoying the fruits of his spoils, which he was fully entitled to, you know, for a period of time, that's fine. But if, you know, we were buying him for a 2-year earnout, so he's going to have to stick out and, you know, make sure the business is growing and integrating fine. He realized that, you know, it wasn't for him. After 6 months of being told what to do by the big PLC machine, this is an entrepreneur who was having his wings clipped in his view, and he just didn't want to stick around. So he took the $3 million earnout, accelerated it. You know, I think we ended up paying him about $1.5 million, and off he was. But the issue there on that side is if you're an entrepreneur, you don't really belong in the PLC machine, which becomes a problem when you're a PLC buying this type of business to make sure you're getting the value that you want from it. So, you know, all fine, well and good for James Kennedy to sell off his business and for him to accelerate his earnout and leave and go off and play golf. But, you know, James Kennedy is an entrepreneur at the end of the day, and he will have an entrepreneurial itch. So what often happens in that situation, or what sometimes can happen, the big risk for a buyer of a business is that when you buy it, you know, you're left with a situation where you're buying a business, you have to integrate, you have to get the synergies. The main value and control of the business is just exited the stage left because he's disenfranchised with the whole thing. And you're there, you haven't fully integrated, you haven't got synergies. So there's an acceleration. So it's a whole integration piece that can be quite complicated with two different type of structures of businesses. And then when you're dealing with the situation whereby you have this business, the entrepreneur is gone, you're trying to, you know, subsume the value and control of that business into your business. Suddenly the entrepreneur has gotten bored of playing golf every day. And you have a business called Kennedy James Limited just starting up in competition. And as you're trying to integrate it, you've got a ferocious competitor started up, you know, in competition because he's got the entrepreneurial itch to go again. He's passed his non-compete phase and he's going again. So there's a whole interesting piece of that in terms of, you know, when you're buying a business, getting what you want from it in the first instance, getting the synergies that may be there that you've evaluated before you've done the transaction, making sure you can deliver those. And of course, everyone wants to drive value and growth. So you want to be able to get a bit more. So you need to be able to do that in an efficient and as swift a period of time as you possibly can before external events kind of take over.
Yeah, I mean, that vibes. Some of my most successful friends in sort of who are entrepreneurs are mad as a box of frogs, as you might say. And you sometimes wonder, well, how the hell did this person manage to build, you know, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars worth of value, you know? And when you look at them and they couldn't organize lunch on time, you know, but they seem to be all over the place and nothing gets finished. And it just seems to be an idea a minute. And you just wonder, well, how does that ever happen? You know, it's almost not fair. I've been reading all the business books. I've been doing courses. I've been learning, doing what you're supposed to do in, you know, reading Harvard Business Review or whatever. And yet these guys waltz in none of that and seem to just, it happens for them. So it's annoying in a way, but it's, you have to admire them. But then I can see how you kind of want, now this is in your practice here. So I can see how a private equity firm might want to put you in because your vibe is quite corporate, if you don't mind me saying. So you've got that experience, you've got that background, you know how to talk to the higher ups, let's call them. Mm. But do you work just for private equity, or is this a scenario where maybe an entrepreneur is listening and they're thinking, well, I'm going to have to deal with corporate land. I need someone to be my translator or my diplomat, let's call it, to help you get, you know, to make sure that if you do a deal, you don't end up actually, okay, you have a few quid, but actually you're depressed and start having affairs or whatever to make your life more interesting, you know, and then, you know, end up ultimately not what you want. So tell me a bit about that. I mean, who's your ideal customer now today post-acquisition? Do you like to be a gamekeeper or a poacher?
Well, I've got a range of, I suppose, when it comes to CFO solutions, which is an area of business, so Capstack is an advisory business, and part of that piece is CFO solutions or fractional CFO solutions, where I'll go in when there's a change event happening. So more often than not, a change event in the business and can involve what I call a corporate finance event. And that's in three stages. You're preparing for the corporate finance event, be it a sale, an investment, a fundraise, or whatever the case is. You're actually going through it, which is, you know, someone has agreed to buy you or invest in you, and they're carrying out the due diligence process and then the investigations in the business. And, you know, the business just may not have the capability to be able to deal with the additional demands on it. You know, people work 7, 8, 10 hour days, suddenly it goes to 15 hours and they just don't have the capacity. And you know, with the best one in the world, there could be some really good finance functions out there who have steeped and experienced in their sector and all very well run, but just don't have the experience of dealing with a corporate finance transaction event. So, you know, there's additional resources needed there. And the third part of the change piece is, you know, the post corporate finance event integration, so post-transaction integration, be it a sale or an investment, whatever the case is. But I suppose you're kind of nearly alluding to the first piece, which is where the entrepreneur has a business and he wants to sell it off, he wants to realize the value of the business. And you know, you're right, I'm a chartered accountant. I've worked in the corporate finance world for, you know, best part of 25-30 years. I've had my own business for 8 years now in terms of the advisory business, so entrepreneur to a certain extent, but I am corporate, like, let's call it a spade, was entrepreneurs in the classical sense out there are the guys who can get the sales and close the deals and all the rest of that, and that's great. And they may have really valuable businesses, but what they may not be able to do is monetize those businesses fully, because they may have, you know, deep personal relationships that are all based on a handshake going back 10 years, and that customer has always been reliable and always turned up. But the reality is, unless there's a contract in place, that piece of value or that piece of business isn't going to be as robust and defendable for the buyer as it would be if you have a contract in place. So whatever the case is, if you provide, I don't know, you're an alarm monitoring company and you install alarms and you get a service agreement afterwards, that's fine. And if it's all done on a handshake, it's going to be more difficult for the buyer, the investor, to be able to say, I can stand over that, because if James Kennedy leaves, you know, is that customer going to leave with him? So there's certain things you can do to groom the business for sale or prepare for sale in terms of going, well, listen, James, you're not ready to sell your business right now, because what you need to do is you need to spend a period of time getting it ready. In other words, all that business you have with, you know, that you turn over every year for alarm monitoring or whatever, the reality is you don't have a contract in place. So what you've got to go and do over the next period of time before you sell your business is go to each of those customers that you have a long-term relationship and say, listen, I need to consummate this relationship in the legal agreement. Can you sign up this 1-year contract or this 2-year contract? And then I'm in a situation as a buyer of that business to go, well, listen, if James Kennedy exits stage left, immediately, I still have value in that business by virtue of that contract and that customer that his business has with that customer. And it's not just all reliant on the fact that James Kennedy has a relationship with that customer and is going back years. And then they always repeat, they're always there. They always, you know, every year they're back every year. Yeah, that's fine. But if you leave, is that still going to be there? So there's certain things that you can do to groom a business for sale or prepare for sale. You know, other things as well, we have what we call a value and control review. So is all the value and the control in James Kennedy, or is it in the actual business? And the more you can extract yourself from that, you'll still be very important to the business, but the more you can extract yourself from the value and control, in other words, if it's 80% reliance on James Kennedy, you need to get it down to 20, 30, 40%. You're still important to the business, you know, and you're the guy, you're the entrepreneur who started it. But the reality is, as a buyer or investor in that business, we need to be able to buy the business and not James Kennedy. Because James Kennedy, as I say, can exit stage left at any stage. Well, unless he's tied in, at which stage we get back to the 9/11 Porsche, he wants to accelerate the 2-year earnout into 6 months. And so, you know, there may be a pretty light C-suite management team, so maybe the things that he needs to do to beef up that management team so that you're actually buying an autonomous business and not just James Kennedy, and you can rely on the fact that there's value and control in that sales director and that ops director and that CFO and that whomever it is. And certain things as well is like, James Kennedy may take a look at the business and go, it's my money. I'm not going to invest the, you know, the requisite amount in terms of systems and controls that it needs to operate, you know, to its maximum potential in terms of using maybe the MI to make the sales team more efficient or the ops being more efficient or, you know, drive value that way. Because you're there going, well, listen, that's money in the business. That's mine. I want to take it out in dividends because it's my business. That's fine. You want to take it out in dividend. That's fine. You're fully entitled to it. But if you want to put it into a situation whereby you're getting ready for sale, you're beautifying for sale, you've got to focus on making sure that there's as much value in the business. Because the reality is you can take your dividend out once, but if you're selling your business, the normal way to value the business in one stream is a multiple of your earnings. So classically, it's EBITDA by a multiple of 4 to 6 times. So you take the dividend out, you don't invest it, you're losing out in the investment in the business, and you're losing out in the fact that, you know, the buyer is going to have to put in that infrastructure or plug it into its infrastructure. So there's a cost there either way that you've kind of foregone in investing in the business. So certain things that you can do that you can go, well, listen, if I invest in the management team, if I invest in, you know, infrastructure in terms of MI, I'm going to get a greater bang for my buck when I come to sell it. If you want to stay, you know, taking dividends out of it, that's fine. But, you know, you're not going to get best value if you want to sell as an autonomous business.
Can I ask, you know, frequently, you know, finance CFOs describe themselves as storytellers, and they use the money or the numbers as a way of telling us a compelling story, you know, and I'm interested by that. And in particular, this instance, so let's say you have a business, you know, all the things you talk about to be sellable, you know, you want to be profitable and growing, you want to have systems in place, you know, you want to not be locked into the business, you want it to be sort of not reliant on any one person, etc. And then if you think through that, you know, let's say you'd have 100 entrepreneurs who managed to get to that stage, you know, a good 80% of them might say, well, actually, hold on, what am I doing selling this? It's a cash flow.
Yeah.
I'm getting, let's say, you know, 20, whatever, I suppose it's just hard cash that comes out every year. And then they do the math on, well, I could sell it for, let's say, 5 times that revenue. But then
EBITDA, not revenue.
I don't. Okay. Important distinction. Yeah. Well, it depends on the industry, right? So, but the
few tales with that one as well about businesses that are valued on turnover or revenue. It's never a good metric. So that never ends well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it makes sense. I mean, logically, because ultimately it's kind of a spreadsheet exercise where, you know, 3 to 5 times is whatever. What is that? That's something like, you know, 15 to 30% return, you know, makes sense for any investment. Yeah. Like if I went and put money in the stock market, I expect 7%. So it's got to be better than that. And, you know, you kind of figure that out. And then any deviance over that. So from the entrepreneur perspective, if you have this great business, it really doesn't make sense to sell because you wouldn't be able to reinvest and get the same return, depending on how you feel about the business. Which then brings me to this question about the story about why people might want to sell. Like, I'm interested as on the buyer side of the table, like what sort of story resonates? Like, you know, someone gets sick, God help me. Like I have a competitor, God help him, he's gone now, but he got sick, you know, he had to sell the business, you know, and that's been tragic. But on the other hand, I can see that was a great opportunity for someone, you know, someone else might just, the only thing that makes sense to me is basically some kind of negative narrative where this guy is retiring, he's had something happen, or whatever. Is that what you look for in a deal? Like, or is that, sounds horrible to say it that way, but let's face it, is that where the opportunities are? Or what sort of narratives are compelling to a buyer as to why someone would give up this great business with great cash flow, great systems, everything, you know?
Well, there's a couple of, if we just take just two different types of buyers, and I know there's a lot more out there than that, but let's just say it's a trade buyer or a private equity buyer, and they'll have different reasons why they'll be able to overpay or pay more than the other party. So if you're a trade buyer and we're in a particular area and there's someone who has just cornered the market in that particular sector, and, you know, from his point of view or her point of view, you know, maybe of a certain age whereby to have built that business, you know, put a lot of energy in over a period of 20, 25 years, and it's just coming to a natural stage in her life where they don't want to devote the energy to the business anymore. They built it to it. They want to cash in. They don't have succession. They don't have children. They just want to monetize the value in the business that they built. So they do all those things to groom the sale, the business for sale. And me as a trade buyer will go, well, listen, I really like that sector. He's kind of cornered it to a certain extent, and we won't be able to get into that area. So I'll buy my way into it. So that's, and, you know, there's certain synergies that in my cost base that I can bolt their business onto my business that I won't, that you know, duplicate cost that I can take out, and therefore it should be what we call value accretive. And also I might take a view that if I align his business to my business, well, then the power of the combined business and be greater and be able to grow it even more so. So there's reasons why trade buyers buy it from that point of view. And then there's, I suppose, there's private equity buyers who, you know, like a business, like the dynamics of the marketplace or whatever, will typically want the C-suite management team to stick around. Funny, the more and more private equity investors that I talk to, the more and more, and this is probably not the best form to say it, aren't overly impressed with the existing CFO and look to replace him pretty early on in the piece. But they like the, you know, the chief executive or the sales or whatever's driving the value in that business they like, because they see that with investment, they can do what they call a roll-up. In other words, they can take a business and they can go out and acquire smaller businesses. And with those smaller businesses, they do a roll-up and the great, you know, over a 3 to 5 year period, which they typically like to invest in, they've grown this business from a certain size to a much bigger size. And also, you know, the bigger the business gets, the more defendable it is. In other words, businesses that have like a 5 million EBITDA are a lot more defendable than businesses with 1.5 million EBITDA. Because if you think about it, both of those businesses could be in a sector, you know, a lot of talk about Trump tariffs at the moment. It could be in a sector whereby, you know, whatever ill winds are coming at them in the next 6 or 12 months, it could mean €1 million hit to the bottom line. The business that's making 5 million euros is a lot more robust and can take, doesn't want to take the hit, but it, you know, the profits are reducing from 5 to 4 million, so it can take it and still go. But if the smaller business is making 1.5 million and suddenly your profits are down to 500,000, you're not too far away from a pretty, you know, concerning event there. So that's typically why bigger businesses are more robust. So if you buy a small business and bolt it on with other businesses and grow to scale, there's an enhancement, inherent enhancement to the value of that business that people see attractive. So I don't know, I've rambled in a couple of different areas. I'm not sure if I really hit.
Well, okay. Well, I heard from what you said there is that actually it is quite a, for the want of a better expression, bookish analysis on, you know, what it is. Like the story, you know, I don't want to, it sounds terrible, but like, you know, the cancer diagnosis, the, you know, the other things that had to drive these things, like, are they important or it doesn't really matter? Like, let's say a convincing narrative, like, so, you know, like a thing that might happen to a business not a million miles away from where I am is you feel like, well, you know, this is a good business. We enjoy taking the profits. We probably know that the business needs more investment, but we're just not doing it. You know, we don't have a personal decision on that. Like, do stories like that make a difference in being able to get an acquisition, or are you kind of fooling yourself? You best know, you know what, it's really just a spreadsheet and there you go. Or have you seen a story where it's like, well, this makes sense on paper here, but you know what, he's also told me that X, Y, or Z, and that's what's helped get the deal done.
Yeah, well, that really comes back to the reasons why you buy. You're looking to buy market share. You're looking, is there an innovative product that could align with your products and, you know, augment what you're providing to the wider market? Right. You know, there's a whole host of reasons why entities, be it trade buyers or private equity buyers, buy businesses. And it's, you know, you never buy it so that it gets smaller. You know, I've only ever been in one situation whereby the mandate was to take something that was very big, get it down to zero as quickly as possible. In a Brewster's Millions type fashion, I say, kind of in a quip type way. And that was NAMA, the National Asset Management Agency, which bought 32 billion of loans, and its only remit was to get it down to zero as quickly, efficiently, as profitable as it could be. So when you buy a business, you're looking to grow it. And you got to be able to buy into the, you know, do your due diligence, your market due diligence, micro due diligence on the business itself to make sure what you're doing as a trade buyer, a private equity buyer, grows the value in it, because otherwise you wouldn't do it. Now, you know, history littered with the, you know, with bad acquisitions, and that's people who haven't done their diligence properly. And maybe some businesses are what I would call, you know, family businesses where people have them and, you know, they get a really nice living out of it. They get, you know, the foreign holidays and kids through fee-paying schools and universities, and all that's taken care of very comfortably, and they have a really nice lifestyle, and they're taking significant amounts of money out of the business, and they're fully entitled to, because, you know, they may have other stakeholders by virtue of debt funders, but if the debt is kept whole and, you know, is performing, the, you know, the lender can say nothing, And that means that the entrepreneur, the shareholder, director of that business, the owner manager of that business can pretty much do as they please in relation to the surplus cash in that business. But as I say, if you want to go to a situation where you want to cash in, want to monetize that business, you've got to go through certain kind of rigors to make sure, well, if you want to maximize the value in it, you know, you do that. But that's not to say that there's not businesses out there that, you know, there's latent value that's kind of hidden that people buy it for. And a classic example is we work quite closely with data valuation partners who are a data valuation business in the UK. So they look to data rich companies to in order to value and seek to monetize the value in the data in their business for what they call a corporate finance event. And the classic example they use is that, you know, they have, you may have an EV charging business throughout the UK and you've got hundreds of charging points around the UK and that's great. And Niall White goes in with his BYD and he charges it up, and James Kennedy goes in with his Merc Hybrid and charges it up, and they generate a revenue from that. And that becomes a, you know, growth profit and EBITDA after cost. And you multiply that EBITDA by a PE multiple and you get to a company valuation for that business. And you think, oh, that's it. That's a classic company valuation. But what it doesn't do is ascribe any value to the data that it has. So if it has hundreds of thousands of chargers every month throughout the UK from various different types of vehicles, it's consuming a huge amount of data and it has a huge amount of data in-house available to it. It doesn't need to know that it's James Kennedy's Merc Hybrid or Niall White's BYD. You know, get around the GDPR issues because our name is not on it, but it does know that it's had 53,000 BYDs charged this month and 37,000 Merc Hybrids charging this month. And this is the performance data that we're getting from it. And yours is, you know, a 2022 car. Mine's a 2020 car. So the difference between my BYD was 2020 and the next BYD comes in is 2023. And the performance. So there's a huge amount of data coming in. Who's that valuable to? Car manufacturers, car companies. So not alone do you have the value, the traditional value in the business, but you may have a huge amount of latent value, is what I call, in the data in that business. So, you know, there's many reasons why you might buy a business. So we've kind of gone through the more traditional ones, but I might turn around and go, well, listen, yeah, okay, we make $1 million out of the charging each year, and that's multiplied by a multiple of five. So my business is worth $5 million. But hang on, this data from hundreds of thousands of chargers every month is worth a multiple of that to the car manufacturer. So you might be able to sell that data piece off for, you know, what would seem to be crazy money. So there's a whole host of reasons why buyers buy that business and I'd want to sell it.
Very good. All right, Niall, thanks very much. This has been an interesting discussion and thank you for listening this far. If you got this far, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com. What are we going to pick today, Niall? I don't know. We could do the mastermind. We could do the newsletter. We could do a range of things. Let's do the newsletter. So you can go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Sign up. It's not just any newsletter. It's actually very interesting. It's a little bit tabloid. I'll tell you what happened, Niall. We had our traditional newsletter where we promote this podcast and all the other great podcast guests that we have. And we had about a, I'll be honest, 20% open rate. Yeah. And then we started saying, well, let's start looking at the latest examples of waste, fraud and abuse we found in the press from the last week. And we started putting those in the newsletter at the header, right? So what are these are examples of basically mistakes finance teams have made, to be honest, at different levels. So this could be not picking up on inefficient use of funds. We've all seen that for charities. Sometimes we had Naomi Campbell in our newsletter 2 weeks ago for something, a charity she was involved with that was flying the execs around first class where they were supposed to be using the money for something else. It could be a municipality that is just going bust because it wasn't controlling its costs in the first place. Again, you could argue down to the finance team had a hand in that. And also we have SMB examples. So where it's just straight up COVID fraud, you know, the famous stimmy checks in the US, yeah. Everyone was getting fat on those for a while, whipping up 400 fantasy employees in one case. That was another story we had there. So anyway, all of these stories are a little bit tabloid, but they serve as a good reminder that if you don't want to end up in our newsletter, maybe you should consider using a product like Procurement Express to make sure you're able to point at every line item and know exactly why it was purchased by whom, what the approval was and what it was used for, and was it coded correctly so that you never end up in our newsletter. And bang, what do you know? Now our open rates are 40%. So give the people what they want. bit of light entertainment at the expense of other people's misfortune, but maybe you'll learn something along the way as well to keep you out of the newsletter. So procurementexpress.com/newsletter. I encourage you to sign up for it. We put a lot of work into it and it's good fun. Thanks, Niall. This has been great.
That's very interesting. For me, when you're talking about your newsletter, that all comes back to people. Some people made a decision which ended up in, you know, an adverse event, which was, you know, their responsibility, it sounds like, and ended up in your newsletter. But, you know, it's people making the right or wrong decision, isn't it? It always comes down to that, for the right or wrong reasons. So if you want to make the right decisions for the right reasons, you know, it comes down to the values of the business as well. If you want to make the wrong decisions for the wrong reasons in the longer term, well, then you'll end up in James Kennedy's Procurement Express newsletter.
Well, maybe that's why you need a fractional CFO, right? They're the mirror that holds up to make sure before you make a decision, hold on. What would Niall say about this Ferrari I'm about to buy on the company car? You know, like,
yeah, the 911. But it also shows you how reputation as well. You know, if you've got a properly run functioning company, or you have someone come in to help you in that kind of journey from a CFO solutions point of view, you know, you're highly likely to end up in James's newsletter. If you don't focus on the right things and you put your reputation at risk, well, then you're leaving yourself liable to end up in James's newsletter.